Hello, welcome to For the Love of Weather. This is the podcast where we explore the Earth's atmosphere and how we are all connected through the weather and climate. I'm Gemma.
And I'm Aisling, and we're both meteorologists and weather presenter, and we just love chatting about the weather. We hope that you enjoy this episode and leave it just enjoying the weather that little bit more and learning something about how the weather and climate can impact our daily lives. Now, I am beyond thrilled today to have Claire Nazir on the podcast. I don't actually feel like you need an introduction, but if you don't know who Claire is, she has basically been on every single channel here in the UK. You've done every single weather presenting job possible. You're still weather presenting. You're still communicating weather and climate. You're still mentoring people. You're still bringing people through. You're still working really, really hard. And me and Gemma are just so thrilled to have you today. You are a meteorologist trained with the Met Office, which interestingly you're working for again now. So you've kind of gone full circle on that. You've also done a fitness video and you write kids' books as well. I mean, and podcasts too. You're basically just absolutely fantastic. We're so thrilled to have you, Claire.
Oh, it's really good to be here. Thank you. I know it's taken too long, really, hasn't it? It's taken 2 years to get to this point where we are now reunited.
Well, okay, if we're honest, we've been doing this podcast about 5 years now.
Wow. And
we weren't brave enough to ask you until 2 years ago. So anyway, we're really, really happy to have you here now. We're just going to jump through. We always just love to ask everyone that we have in the podcast, where was that little first spark of joy where you thought to yourself, I think I might do something with the clouds or the weather?
Well, there's a couple of sort of moments or sort of milestones really early on. But if you, I don't know, you probably don't remember because I'm a lot older than you, but the Guardian newspaper used to have the synoptic chart every day on one of its pages. I think it was the back page. And I used to cut it out every day and just put it in a book because it was really good to have a bird's eye view of what's happening across Northern Europe. I lived in Milton Keynes in Buckinghamshire. Not a lot went on there, but I was really fascinated with clouds. And it was my first sort of understanding of how you can visualize weather in a way where you can take in a huge amount of information very, very quickly. So that was my first sort of instance where, and I was only probably 12 or 13 at the time, and I just loved anything to do with fluids. So that's the air and also water, so oceans and rivers. And then eventually, if you fast forward from sort of school, degree, master's, I joined the Met Office, very lucky to actually be employed by them in 1994, I think it was. There was probably 800 applicants for two jobs. So it was an absolute sort of like, wow, I can't believe I've made it. And for the first 5 months, you go on to a residential course in Reading, Shinfield Park, which it was just awesome because I was studying the love of my life, my passion really, which is meteorology. And the first thing you do is you learn how to become an observer of weather. And I think that is really important. And in fact, since then, I've mentored many children, students. And what we do, first of all, is we sit on a park bench and we look at the sky because it just represents what's happening in the atmosphere. You can see almost the physics and the dynamics in action. And I think that is just the most beautiful thing about weather. It's before your eyes. So, you know, air rising, so the air currents, the temperature as it falls, the humidity of the air, moisture content, all of those things are represented by what clouds are there or not there, or how it feels, what the wind is doing. And I remember leaving Shinfield Park in Reading one afternoon after we'd done our observation course. And it's a proper career observing the weather. And, you know, I've met many amazing observers who can literally tell the cloud base to probably 100 meters, if not less. They are impressive people. And for many, many years, I worked with observers when I was working in different weather centres. Now it's slightly different the way the Met Office is set up. I remember just driving along the M4 back to home and thinking, oh God, look, there's a cumulonimbus cloud. And I could see the absolute beauty of this huge cloud, which had almost arms coming out at the top as it sort of spread out, because we know it becomes, it sort of pushes towards the top of the weather making layer of the atmosphere, which is the troposphere, and it can't go any further, so it has to spread. And the how dynamic, I mean, I've used that word a few times now, but how powerful these clouds are, and what they're trying to do is just resume an equilibrium in the atmosphere by allowing all of this heat to rise rapidly, explosively, and then along with that you get these really heavy showers, which could be thunder, lightning, hail, gusty winds and all of that. So it's the first time I was able to recognize in the sky, oh God, that's a CB, as we call it. And for me, that was a proper moment of, I'm getting it. I'm understanding it on more than one level.
Oh God, so much of what you say resonates with me. It's literally like a bit watching a big machine every day. So I worked as an observer as well for a while on one of the airfields, and like, pinch me. They were paying me to report the cloud type. But yeah, if you're observing the cloud, it's the fundamental of all science, isn't it? Observation. So absolutely. If you're watching the cloud, you can change the sky. And I always used to feel like a bit of a fraud giving a farmer a forecast, because those guys know their field so much better, you know, than all of us. But what a beautiful start to what you do. How you describe it is poetic. It's poetic. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I think it's, you're absolutely right. I mean, I did a lot of observing when I'm sorry about that rattle. I'm just feeding my puppy, who wants attention as well as trying to focus on you girls. So I worked at London Weather Centre when it was a proper weather centre, three stories and probably 50 people working there. And I'd have to go up onto London Weather Centre roof every hour to report the weather. So look at the temperature, the wet bulb, what's going on in the sky, how much cloud there is. It's measured in octaves. And I was privileged enough to be there on Christmas Day, where at the time, the definition of a white Christmas was one flake of snow falling on London Weather Centre. So that was a really important job, and something which, again, I took a lot of pride in. Like you said, it's just an amazing experience to just be up there in London. You can see the whole of London from London Weather Centre. And that was my first sort of positioning, really. I worked at Plymouth Weather Centre, and I went to London, then I went to Norwich Weather Centre. So there were centres, sort of commercial centres, all the way across the UK, where meteorologists sort of just focused not only on regional weather but also national weather, and did a lot of radios, but also aviation, road forecasting, particularly in the winter, offshore. It was just a brilliant hub of very interesting and clever people with one shared passion.
You have, for as long as you've been studying the weather, you will have been like myself and Gemma in terms of reading about the climate and knowing that the climate is changing. And we all know that the climate changes, but what we're experiencing at the moment is something at an accelerated rate. So I'm going to just fast forward you to 2022. Can you just like walk us through when you first found out about this might actually happen, and how was that for you? How did you feel?
So the 2022 heat wave, in fact, there were five surges of heat during the summer of 2022 in the UK. It felt very personal. It felt personal for many reasons, but we have lots of thresholds in weather and climate. One particular one, which we'd been talking about for a while, is the how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere. And there was a professor of climatology called Professor Charles Keeling, who back in the 1950s said, when we hit 400 parts per million, then we're in clear and present danger. Now that happened in the 2010s. So we were basically free falling from that moment onwards. Now, if we go back to the beginning of my proper TV career, I was at Anglia TV, which was where I started. Then I went to ITN, and then I left the Met Office and joined GMTV, where I reported on the 2003 heatwave. I remember going to my editor at the time, early 2000s, and saying, I want to do a story on climate change. You know, it's happening. It really is. And the map of UK will be redrawn because of sea level rise. And he said, well, what's the timeline for that? And I said, well, probably 100 years. For this dramatic sort of change in the way that our coastline will change because of erosion, because of the expansion of the seas, because our, you know, we're, there's more heat in the atmosphere, and also the melting of land ice, basically, which allows for, well, if we lost all of the ice in the world, I think sea level would be above 70 meters, but you know, there are increments. And he just said no. He said no. Make it 20 years and you've got yourself a story. But 100 years, it's like no one's interested. It's for the grandchildren's grandchildren. And it was a very interesting moment for me. And then 2003 happened, where it was unprecedented. We saw so many people lose their lives. We call them excess deaths because of heat. The numbers were extraordinary. They were more so in Europe. I think there were 70,000 deaths in the UK. I think it was just under 3,000. Even so, every death because of heat is a really bad one. And we could almost see where that trajectory was going. And then fast forward to 2022, things had changed a lot in terms of climate science, and in particular how we analyse the climate change fingerprint on any extreme weather event. And we're far more savvy to communicate it now. So there was a real change in the 2010s on that, which I know that you know a lot about in terms of what we call attribution studies. I'm sure it's not the first time that phrase has been used on this podcast, but sort of analysing and detecting that climate change influence, and that's human-induced climate change because of the amount of carbon dioxide we pump into the atmosphere and how that changes our weather cycles. So by this point in 2022, I think the general public have got a really good understanding, most of them, that we are now on the doorstep. We are living and breathing climate change. So something which was pie in the sky in the 1960s, and that's a temperature reaching 40 degrees, and that's another threshold that we talk about, became reality. And it became reality a long time, really, in terms of weather forecasting than we would normally forecast an extreme weather event. So even a week or so before, we could see that these temperatures were rocketing, and it was happening across the near continent anyway, where we saw temperatures in the 40s. And we could see that everything was almost sliding toward this critical mass of that temperature peaking to just above 40 degrees. We'd already had a heat wave in June and the temperatures were surging again. So it was worrying. It really was worrying. And it was something which was nothing to celebrate, because this was a deadly heat. So much so, the CEO of the Met Office, Penny Endersby, Professor Penny Endersby, did a public statement saying, "This, be careful. This is going to get worse. People are going to die." And this is not just those who have underlying health conditions. This is not just people who are very old and cannot moderate their temperature or live in care homes where there's no air conditioning. Obviously, they are more impacted, but it's the general public. Though, don't go running, don't go cycling in this heat. It's really dangerous. So as we entered the 18th of July, I went to Cambridge on an outside broadcast for Channel 5. That's where I anchor now. And the heat was, as I arrived at Cambridge Station, it felt like there was a hairdryer blowing my face. That's how hot it was. And we all have that experience. We all remember that heat, something we'd never experienced before. We probably had if we'd been on holiday, but with a nice sea breeze and maybe lower humidity, rather than going about our working day. It's a very different type of experience. And I think that day the temperatures peaked just below that 40 degree. And then come the 19th of July, it just went off. I mean, it wasn't just one place. It was bang, bing, 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 bing. One station reported temperature into just peaking into another. And it's just like station records were broken right across the board. And the difference between this heat wave in 2022 and the 2003, it was far further north and west. You know, like everybody was touched by this heat wave. And so the mechanism was fascinating. So as a meteorologist with a weather hat on, it's like, where has this come from? Well, we normally talk about the surge of heat just moving up from the south, from Iberia, from North Africa. But there was a new mechanism which we were really discussing, and just discussing in terms of public domain as well as, you know, with scientists. And that was the compression of the high pressure. So heavy air descending down, and when you compress air, it releases heat. And that really was the mechanism that pushed that temperature over that 40 degree mark into a realm that we've never experienced before. And then obviously the fires happened, and it was heartbreaking. It really was. People's lives were devastated in places. Now, we've seen this in other places, like a few years before in Lytton in Canada, where I can't remember what the temperature, I think it was 43 degrees. And this is a very similar latitude to the Isle of Wight in Canada. And 90% of Lytton, a village in Canada, burnt down. And people are still not back in their houses now. So this is not just short-term impacts. There are long-term impacts. Obviously, loss of life is one, but it's devastating. So we saw many, many fires, not only in London where there was, you know, they were prolific, but there were wildfires elsewhere. Roads just basically melted. Railway lines buckled. Yeah. I mean, you both have, you know, you both live in different parts of the world to me. It was like, this is a reality check.
So was that really different for you then in terms of the communication of it from 2003 to like 2022? Like, do you feel like the people around you were more open to listening to you, or, you know, telling you not to complain, it's good weather, you know?
I think people understood the messaging. The messaging, I think, was really, really powerful. And we learned a lot of lessons from 2003. In fact, policy changed. Policy changed across Europe, across UK. There was the tier system that came in, green, amber, red. Obviously, the warnings as well were really quite critical. And, you know, the first ever red warning for heat was issued during that time, which is a very clear way of getting that information to the general public. An important way. And then obviously we have the heat health warnings for England, which are much more for care professionals. And in fact, we've had heat waves before that, which were similar, but not so intense. And if you measure the impacts, they have been less relative to 2003 because of all the messaging that has been put in place. So if you are well informed, then you can actually make informed decisions. And that's something which is an underlying value and theme of the Met Office, and really important. It's about keeping people safe, but allowing them to thrive as well. And there's a paper that has just been released in 2025 by Dr. Gillian Kay on 40 degree research. So, you know, there's not much between 39.9 and 40.5. It's still a really, really hot. And in fact, for Met Office criteria for heat waves, that's 26 to 28, 25 to 28. And that's, they define that as the threshold, where that's when your health really becomes impacted. For some, it's going to be less than that, but as a general population, depending where you are geographically. But the key findings from the Dr. Gillian Kay paper were fascinating and very quite scary as well, because it was, again, another reality check. Let me just give you some of the key findings here, just in bullet points. In 1960s, as I said, vanishingly small chance of seeing 40 degrees. In 1980s, one in 150-year event. In 2023, that had risen to one in 24 years. And that is an accelerating change now. So we're not talking about future climate change here. We're talking about the current climate. And within 12 years, there's a 50-50 chance that summer in the UK could exceed 40 degrees. That's startling. And that really represents the rate of increase in carbon dioxide occurring in our atmosphere and how our temperatures are literally going in the wrong direction. And if this isn't a wake-up call, I don't know what is, because people are, you know, people are dying. People are getting ill from it. People can't get to work. I mean, during the 2022 heat wave, you know, doctors couldn't get actually to their hospitals. There was a crisis going because the transport system just ground to a halt. So it's the infrastructure as well as absolute, just like the total sort of direct point impacts. And I think this is the thing that we have to realise, that this is going to happen more and more. And can we adapt to it? Well, we've got an absolute maze of railways, which some of them still from the Victorian age. And most of our roads are tarmac, which melt at a lower point than that. So no, we're not prepared.
Do you know, Claire, we covered a story here recently, but basically Bedfordshire sent their gritters out last week during the peak of the heat to stop the road from melting. Their gritters. I have never in my career, I'd never thought of having to do a forecast for gritting in the summer.
I'm astounded. I've never heard that. So that is the measures we're going to now to try and keep the roads flowing and people getting from A to B during a heat, which could be every other year.
Yeah. And I just see the revised maximum temperature for the Met Office this year is now 35.7. So it was 36 degrees. So it just those nuances, like you say, I know 40 degrees is another ball game, but those high 30s are, we're not supposed to be seeing them as frequently, you know, as we're seeing them.
And also from that study as well, it said that we could see temperatures several degrees above 40 degrees as well, which is just the fact that we saw 40 degrees is astonishing. But then the fact that we could see them more than 40 degrees in the UK is just like, wow, that, as you say, that needs to be the wake-up call that this is like here and happening now.
Yeah.
Every time we tend to like a climate thing online or we're going to something, it's all like the cost of climate is more to not fix it. So we just, you know, we need to just crack on with it. We've talked about a lot of heavy stuff there, Claire. And I think we all feel the same. I think we're all very emotionally driven by this topic as we've sort of really watched it explode, as has the science in our career time as well, you know, about how we actually really know and really understand this. But shall we reflect back on some nicer moments in your career?
Yes.
Do you want to tell us, is there any outstanding things that always pop into your head that really bring you joy?
I've had an amazing career, all thanks to the Met Office. That's where I started. And it keeps on just blossoming in different ways. I do a lot of work now with the clean energy transition and working in commercial work, in communications, as well as the Met Office work, which is really interesting. So I felt during the 2010s into the COVID, really, that we understand the science now. We understand where we're going with this. It can't be more blatant than the messaging that we're putting out. So it's about supporting the solutions. And obviously some of those solutions come in the form of innovation to actually not only adapt, but to mitigate the level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So I'm working a lot with startups and clean energy companies who are really trying to push the boundaries in technology, and also with leadership to just working with leaders who have vision, are transformational, who have a voice which really carries. And so we can accelerate the change to a clean, green economy.
Have you got any examples of the startups or the organisations you work with? Like anything that you've been like, wow, I can't believe they're doing that.
Oh, God. Great question. So I interviewed, I would say it's 2 years ago now, a guy you've got to get onto your podcast. He's amazing. His name is Stephen Crozier. And he's the founder of a company called Re-Energize. And that's R-E-H-E, Energize. Now, they've reimagined hydroelectric. Okay. So what they see is, yes, you know, we've got wind, we've got solar, and that's brilliant. But what happens when it's a cloudy, calm day? And that's always the conundrum that a lot of people talk about. And it's storage. Storage is the way to go. Storage in terms of mostly battery storage. But what he's designed, and he's still in demonstration site sort of level, but it's going in the right way. Initially crowdfunding, now people are just chucking money at it because it's going to be an amazing solution. He's reduced the height of hydroelectric by, I'm going to say half, if not three quarters, by increasing the density of the fluid that he's using. So it's a really clever, nice physics concept there. So the rate at which the fluid falls falls because of gravity when it's needed allows the generators, the turbines, to move even quicker, generating more electricity. And his vision is to have these little hillocks. So when they're actually built, they become a hill, just a green hill, so you can't even see where they are. And he sees these dotted up and down the motorways to charge EVs.
He's so clever.
And he's such a clever guy, honestly. He's amazing. And you just think, this person's just thought outside the box. It's something, the water wheel. I mean, where I live in Cheshire, there's the Quarry Bank water mill. And that was from the 1700s, but even before that, you know, wind power, water power, they were the things that generated the turbines in any shape or form to actually create work to allow us to have a better life as human beings. So for him to reimagine that for the 21st century is, I think it's genius and also just so practical. So that is an example of the type of innovation is going on here in the UK, but elsewhere as well. And it's awesome. And it makes you feel good, you know. And so we've talked about heat waves. We talk about the impact and how bad it is. And it is. And everything in terms of the numbers are going in the wrong direction. But there are people doing amazing work.
Giving hope.
Yeah.
Do you know, just perhaps this is an aside, but myself and Gemma were at the Blue Earth Summit 2 years ago. Oh, maybe it was last year's one. And there was a futurist on stage and he was talking about this analogy of New York in the early 1900s with all the horse-drawn carts. And there was a problem of horse dung, which led to the problem of flies. And he was sort of saying at the time that they were trying to, how do you get rid of the problem of flies? And what he was like, the combustion engine came along, which obviously, as we know, started off electric, which is crazy. But he was saying, like, he doesn't think that we can imagine what would. So suddenly the combustion engine came along and it was all gone.
Yeah.
Like, it was something that nobody would have been able to imagine. So maybe this is one of those things, you know, one of these moments where it will suddenly, it will be like, God, whoever thought of that, you know?
Yeah, I think that's one. I mean, I was chatting to somebody who was very much into creating meat-like food out of plants. And he said, now this will take off when it's convenient, when it's cheaper or price parity with meat, and it tastes good. And these are the three things that he has to tick, that's the ticking of the box. And in terms of energy, they call it the energy trilemma. So basically, it's ticking a box for climate change, which is really important. It has to be affordable for everybody to be able to use it, and it has to be accessible as well. So there's a lot of logic in terms of what works and what doesn't work. But some people describe the uptake of certain new technologies like an S curve. So initially it's very slow. Innovation is expensive. Like, the first meatless meat burger cost about £100,000 to produce, whereas now it's much cheaper. But in terms of, say, wind power in the UK, yes, where I come from in Milton Keynes, there was a wind turbine in the 1980s. But now that's the cheapest form of electricity we're getting. And, you know, there have been days where 95% of our electricity generation has been from green energy. So the more that it is taken up by industry and consumers, the cheaper it becomes, and the market then flows. And that's when you get that sort of that S curve going from a real plateau to something which just surges up. Some people now call it an F curve. So it's even smaller, the uptake, and then it sort of rockets up. So that's a really good way of understanding and also measuring what you're trying to design and whether there is a place for it. And there's a place for it when we actually do need it, you know, when other things become more expensive or not accessible, or they have a detrimental effect on our lives rather than other people's. You know, it's selfish, really, in a way.
Can you just tell us a little bit about Colin the Cloud?
So I wrote Colin the Cloud years ago. I think I before I had children, I had my child, should I say. So it was back in the 2000s. And it was a 10,000 word essay, really, which obviously no child was ever going to read. And then I had Sienna. And then I sort of rewrote it again and again and again. And then until eventually I found a publisher and an illustrator. So it came out, I'm going to say, I can't remember what year it was, 2018, 2019. And it's a little story about a cloud who has aspirations to be, to travel around the jet stream and see the world. So it's just introducing some really simple physics with some beautiful illustrations of this adventure of a cloud. And I added some of my family members into it as well. So Arif, my dad's Pakistani, Arif, it's the wise old cloud who told him to follow his dreams. And there's others in there. And it's a really magical story. Then I've written four other books, three have been published. And then I wrote a book for an older reader with Simon King, What Does Rain Smell Like, which was a brilliant collaboration with him, which went out into, I think it was five or six different translations around the world. It coincided with COVID, which wasn't great. So, but it was a really good book to, I sort of relearned the stuff that I had studied at Reading at my, you know, in back in the day, yeah, at Shinfield College, because you have to go back to basics. And yeah, it's really, I love writing. I'm writing another book at the moment. So I'm loving it, absolutely loving it. And it's a really nice way to actually have ownership of something, because when you're on television, you're only as good as your last broadcast, really. People, yep, forget, you just have to just keep on going. I say a treadmill going as fast as possible. Whereas when you're writing, it's something which is, it stays, it's there, it's, you know, it's
in. And it is, and it's also allowing you to explore that other love of your life, as you call it, like it, and leave a footprint of that in your own way with all of the lovely knowledge that you have, you know.
Yeah,
I think reading what's to come.
Yeah, it's one of those where you once you've got the bug, it's hard to hard not to. I read a book called The Artist's Way a few years ago about having discipline in writing every day. Even if it's just brain dumping what you're worried about or what you're asking, you know, every morning, and your creative juices really do flow. And then a recent article I read on using AI to create creative writing or just writing reports, there was a study done on people's skill set before using AI and then after. And you do lose, those skills do become numb or dampened, because you lose that sort of that daily creativity to really try and express something. So, I mean, I'm talking from someone who's a lot older than, you know, AI's only been in my life for a few years now, whereas I know my daughter has it just literally on her phone. And I think it's really important to write and to keep on those creative flows, just to be able to communicate weather and climate in ways which touches many people's lives. So it can be an inspiration for the next generation. And again, so that they understand what's going on in our atmosphere.
How do you do it all, Claire? You're doing so much. Like, how do you fit all of this in?
Well, I don't commute to work anymore. I've got my own TV studio here, so that really helps. It takes many hours of a day away from, you know. And I just, you know, when you're doing something you love, Gemma, it's just lovely, isn't it? I think that, you know, that's why we're in weather, all of us, is because we are, the weather is a challenge every day. We're always going to be students of weather, students of climate. There's always going to be something else that comes up, which you go, I haven't seen that before. And it's always going to be something which will test you. And that's the most wonderful thing about it. You can't get complacent as a meteorologist, otherwise you get it wrong.
Yeah, we talk about this all the time. Like, that's one of the things that I really love working in weather and climate, is that literally most days, if not every day, you are learning something. And it's just, there's so much out there. And the more you look into a subject, you're like, oh, I didn't know about that. And I didn't know about that. And then it opens up your world even more. And you're like, I just find myself researching all the time now.
Or relearning, like you say, Claire, like back to basics. Sometimes I'm like, oh, how does that work again? You know, like, where you never, but I never stop wanting to relearn. Yeah. I might have the same like capacity I used to, but I definitely don't ever stop wanting to relearn. And I always think that as well. The day I come in here and I think, oh, I'm not learning anything, or the day we do a podcast and I'm not interested in it, then yeah, it's time for the next thing. But there's just so many things in weather and climate. We have learned so much from people coming onto this podcast, and just their kindness as well of giving us their time. It just blows our mind, you know, that they do that. We have just, there's been a wealth of information.
Well, the other day you did a little favour for me, because I had work experience kids here learning about weather. The first task we did was, let's just navigate around the UK and see if you know where Scotland is. You know, it's one of those.
Yeah.
And then Ash, you came on as the weather presenter, radio presenter, throwing down the line for them to create or talk about the weather in terms of a forecast. And you were brilliant how you coaxed out all that information, because it is in there. You know, we live and breathe this stuff just as normal human beings, maybe less so if we work in an office and we're in a car all day. But certainly when you're outside, you have a sense of what's going on. And you brought out the best in these two students because they were nervous, but they didn't realize how much they actually knew, you know.
I do loads. School visits are my thing. You know, I wish I could do I wish I could do one every morning. And I just love championing the next generation and people who just take a moment to come and ask you a question. There's a tiny bit of drive there, and just rewarding that drive. And then even the ones that don't, when you go into the school, you never know what little mind you might just like pick upon, or what little bit of science you might accidentally tell them that you didn't know that, like, in spite of them. Anyway, I love that you do that. And they are so lucky they had a personal one-to-one with you there. Wow.
Yeah, they were good. And I think I was in a primary school the other day, and I was amazed how much they knew about climate change. They were asking really quite heavy questions. And so I think the you know, teaching profession, you know, the schools are doing an amazing job really relaying that information, teaching the climate as well as the weather. And that in a way is down to what's available on YouTube, what's available on, you know, things like BBC Biteside, the Met Office website. You know, all of us in our own way are communicating in different ways. And I think with teaching, you have to be able to explain things at least three or four different ways for people to understand it. And I think that's what's available now across the board. The information is there, but also misinformation and disinformation, which is such a shame. And for some small sort of subsection of the population, throwing out something which lands in the ether, which people can then latch onto, which is wrong information, is appalling. It's the lack of responsibility is unbelievable.
How do you deal with misinformation then?
Well, misinformation is really when people are relaying facts which aren't right, but not on purpose. So they've been misinformed. And at the Met Office, there's a proper charge really to correct that information, whether it's headlines from newspapers or maybe social media people who are trending. So it's a gentle, like, actually, this is correct and this isn't. With the disinformation, I mean, I've been on radio interviews before where people have just really bamboozled me with information which is rubbish, and I've just taken them out to say, you know, this is wrong. How dare you? It's a real, you have a responsibility to give correct information. And at the Met Office and many scientific institutions around the world, they dedicate every day to, you know, stringently making sure that information is correct, to the best information that they have. And it's verified, it's peer reviewed. It's not just one maverick just saying one thing, hoping they've got it right or hoping they've got it wrong, to actually just stir it up. So it does come from the top. It comes from the authority of an organisation which is trusted, like the Met Office, like Meteor France, like the Japanese Met Service, all of these amazing institutions doing incredible work and dedicating their professional lives, these people, to actually making sure the right information gets out. So, as I said before, people can make the right decisions.
That's the wonderful thing about science. There's just no international boundaries. Scientists have been working together since, you know, whenever, what's that? Telegraph, you know, scientists have been coming together. They push through it all. They push through all of the governments or changes of governments and everything, and they just have to keep on going. Hear, hear to scientists. That's what I say. Gemma, we're going to move on. Claire, we would just like to get to know you a little bit better. Gemma has a load of lovely little questions.
Okay.
We just love to ask people, and we just can't believe they have an answer to.
No pressure.
They're very random. So they're all just quick fire. So there's a couple of weather related, and then most of them are just random. So what's your favourite season?
I like every season. I like change. I'm a Gemini. I just love change. So it's like, you know, I love it when April happens and you get those really early mornings where they're light. I'm sad. My birthday's on the 20th of June. So the 21st is solstice. I'm very sad on that day because the nights start drawing in. But I love that Christmas crispness of an autumn morning where the fog is just hovering in the valley and you have a real sense of the colour and that sunshine, which is sort of slowly dwindling. And then a really wonderful, I mean, I don't mind wet and windy weather, especially after some dry conditions on a beach, feeling the energy in the atmosphere on a very cold and wet and windy December day where you then go home and have hot chocolate. So I love every season.
You've got such a lovely way of explaining everything.
I know. I'm like, it's just like poetry listening to you. I'm like, I just want to follow you around and listen to what you're saying.
I could just visualize everything. I could visualize myself on the beach in the wind. I was just like, that is so lovely.
Thank you, you both.
What is your favorite cloud?
Okay. I really like the fish. You know what they called, now you're better at this stuff than I am. What's the stratocumulus cloud, which almost looks like it's a fish scales? Undulation you get.
Mackerel sky.
Yeah, yeah. Mackerel sky. That's the one. Yay. I love a mackerel sky. Outer cumulus clouds. So 10,000, 14,000 feet in the air. I'm using feet still. So sorry. Well, you have to, you see.
They still do though in clouds, right? Like if you look.
Which is bizarre, isn't it?
A meter, it's in feet still, isn't it?
And we still talk in millibars rather than, well, I do in hectopascals.
Oh, so do I.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So yeah, macro sky.
And if you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Time travel.
Where would you go?
I would love to go back to the past and tell people what's going to happen, which you can't do. That's a no-no. I just love different, I'm very much into past life regression. So just going back and just seeing different eras of life, how people lived. I sometimes walk through the woodland near where I live, think, actually, I could be medieval now because this woodland hasn't changed that much. And then just imagine that actually the trees are canopies. They keep the rain off. They keep the ambient temperature on a level. I could almost sleep under the sky at night knowing that there is sort of some sort of heat allowing me not to cool down too much. And I always think about that in terms of how did people used to live? How did they cope with life? But if that's the only thing you know, then you survive in under any realm. I mean, we've got different challenges.
I'm very similar with that. There's a Roman ruins near where I live, and it just blows my mind. So they've like done loads of archaeological geophysics on it. So it's not actually changed. You know, like the course of the river hasn't actually changed in the time that's been there. And I genuinely do stand there sometimes. I'm like, my God, you know, somebody looked at that wall. Somebody put that brick there. I love social history. It's fascinating to me as well. Yeah. And I, you know, the average temperature of a room when we had houses was like 16 degrees or something. You know, it's just, I love all of that. It is that connection with nature, and probably knowing it'll be standing there a lot longer than we will.
Yeah, absolutely. I sometimes walk down the road and try and pretend that I just come into my body and just look around to see the wonders of what's happening just, you know, near my doorstep. And I find that really like, let's just look at everything with a fresh view and just appreciate it. Appreciate my little puppy or where I live or my daughter. Just like, oh my God, I've just been transported into this body and I've got an amazing life. I'm very lucky.
I think, isn't that word like glimmers? So like finding little moments in a day. I think as well, you know, as you get older in life, different things happen to you. And I think they become more and more important to just be present in a little moment. And
absolutely. Yes.
I appreciate it. Totally. Yeah. And be grateful for the nothingness happening in it, because when stuff happens.
So much stuff. Yeah. We're so busy.
If you were a fruit or vegetable, what would you be?
Fruit or vegetable. Well, I love an avocado, but I'm now a bit worried about how they're farmed. So
yes, yeah,
the carbon footprint, the water footprint is huge on them. But I do love avocados. I really do. If I was going to be an animal, I'd be a penguin. If that's more of a, you know, that's a, for me, for a fruit or vegetable, because I'm thinking about eating them, I think, you know, whereas a penguin, you don't farm penguins. They have a great life. They love swimming. They just love jumping into water, don't they? And they waddle around. They're very community focused. I wouldn't want to be an emperor penguin, though, because they look like they have a really hard life in the Antarctic. You know,
Got two more questions. So if you can invite one person to dinner, it could be anybody at all from any historical time frame or even a fictional character. Who would it be?
Right. Right now, it would be Mia Mottley, who is the Prime Minister of Barbados. Amazing, powerful speeches at COP. She's a tour de force. She's a woman she's a woman to be reckoned with. She's absolutely incredible and a champion for small islands, particularly where we're going in terms of impacts, whether it's, you know, more powerful storms or sea level rise, etc. So yeah, Mia Mottley, I'd love to sit down with her and just listen to her speak. And then, you know, sometimes you just need somebody to say, well, I've got this issue. I think she'd sort me out every time. So, yeah.
I think you're going to have dinner with her. Put that out into the universe. I bet you it's going to happen.
I was lying in bed the other day thinking, if I had to have a weather station anywhere in the world, I had to work independently as a weather forecaster, I'd be on a hill in Barbados. Mia down the road, a nice beach up the road.
Cup of tea, Mia, in the morning.
And our final question is, what's one thing that you wish everybody knew about the weather?
God, that's a really hard one because that changes from day to day. I think the most wonderful thing about weather is that as a system, what you do here affects what happens thousands of miles away. There's an amazing book which came out when I was a student, actually, called The Chaos Theory, by James Gleick. And he had a beautiful analogy about butterfly wings. And there is a lot to be said about, you know, one tiny thing happening in one place and how it does have a ripple effect. And you do see that in weather. And I think that makes it so majestic and so huge and bigger than us. So, yeah, maybe that.
Again, I'm with the poetry, Claire. I'm ouch, isn't it, to you?
You need to write a book about weather poetry.
About how I feel about the weather. I'm inspired by it. I'm like, I need to rethink how I'm looking at the weather. It's beautiful. Absolutely. So powerful.
Well, that's very kind. It's great hanging out with you. This has been my best lunchtime I've had for a long time. Because even though I work on my own, it's my puppy who sees me broadcast every day. He's like, is that okay? I mean, I'm sure people are watching as well, but it's really nice to have company.
Claire, thank you so much for your very, very precious time. It's just such a joy to talk to you. We love what you do. Can't wait to see what you're going to do in the future. No doubt a million other things after talking to you on this podcast, and hopefully having some tea with Mia Mottley. That would be pretty cool, wouldn't it?
Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much for your company. It's been really good. And I love your podcast. It's brilliant.
Thank you.
So keep up the good work.
Oh, thanks so much, Claire. That means a lot to us. So thank you. If you have liked this episode, we would love it if you would subscribe, rate, review, and share the podcast with a friend. We're hoping that lots of people will listen to the podcast while they're outside having a walk, embracing and enjoying the weather. So if you've done that, please let us know. If you would like to follow us on social media, we are For the Love of Weather. And if people want to find you, Claire, on social media, where can they go?
I'm on LinkedIn, Claire Nazir.
Brilliant. And we just hope that you leave this episode loving the weather just that little bit more.
Thanks so much for listening. Bye. Thank you.